Morning, we welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room today, and although we welcome all of you, we have special guests, and we have students from Horning Middle School. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to come to the courtroom, listen to an oral argument, and then meet with a justice at the noon hour. And the justice has been assigned for the day to meet not only with the students, but whoever wishes to attend that session. This is a national award-winning program, and we've had thousands of students over the years. We discuss at the noon hour after the second case the procedures the court uses in taking a case, deciding a case, and then ultimately releasing the opinion. The substantive issues of the cases are not discussed, but you're all invited. The students have gotten some material about the case they're about to hear. Would anyone like a summary of the issues in the case and the facts? If you would like a summary, raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. All right. Thank you. Let me introduce the court to you all. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and she is the justice selected for today to meet with the students. Seated to her right is Justice David Prosser, and to his right and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the first case. Let me just go through the lineup, if I might. Representing Asma Masri is Attorney Lawrence G. Albrecht. You have 25 minutes. And then we will have 15 minutes for Attorney Amy Schmidt-Jones of Michael Best, representing medical colleges, and Attorney Stephen C. Kilpatrick, Assistant Attorney General, representing the State of Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Committee. And then Mr. Albrecht has 5 minutes in rebuttal. Agreed upon? Is that correct? All right. Mr. Albrecht, we'll start with you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am Lawrence G. Albrecht, and our firm, First Albrecht & Blondes, represents Asma Masri, the petitioner in this case. Before the court is the issue of whether Ms. Masri's reporting of medical and ethical misconduct was protected from retaliation under the Health Care Workers Protection Act, which I'll refer to as the Act. Lurk concluded that she was not protected because she was not an employee, which is the key interpretive word in dispute in this case. Our position is that Lurk's conclusion is not entitled to deference by this court, as I will argue, and that Ms. Masri should be deemed an employee and given the opportunity, which is all she seeks, after 5 years of legal process to prove before the investigative agency that indeed she was subject to retaliation and that she has available to her the remedial scheme which the Health Care Worker Protection Act borrows from. So there are two issues I would like to focus on. The first is the standard of review and whether Lurk's unreasonable interpretation of the statute which disregards the core statutory purpose of protecting public health and safety in this case was ignored entirely in the Lurk decision. This case consequently presents a case of first impression interpreting that core fundamental remedial purpose of protecting public health and safety.
Counselor, do you agree with Lurk that if she is not an employee, she cannot use the statute?
We do believe that that is an accurate reading of the statute, correct. And yes. And the second issue, which I will address also, is, in fact, and in law, why Ms. Masri is an employee for purposes of entitlement to proceed under the Act.
Tell As me I indicated, what, hey, before you begin, what are her remedies if she's not a paid person? We agree she's not compensated in cash or money, right? She has other compensations, but not money.
Correct. The grant, there was a grant, when I go through the particulars of her situation, there had been, in fact, a grant secured for her of $500 a month. But leaving that aside, she had not yet received it. That is true. The remedies, however, which are very important for all persons, but particularly for professional people at the beginning of her career, would be to have a declaration that her rights were violated. She has it currently on her permanent professional record that she had been terminated from her position at the Medical College of Wisconsin. That is a stigma on her record which a remedy can address in addition to any other remedies that may be available, and including, of course, compensation for her fees and costs during this long process. But I would like to focus on
attorney fees?
Well, we believe that there would be attorney's fees available, but the primary remedy for her is the vindication of her good faith reporting of what she believed to be medical misconduct. Right now, that is a permanent stain on her professional record, which I trust we can all appreciate. Now, with respect to the standard of review, this is a case of first impression addressing who is an employee under the Act and who is protected from retaliation. And to resolve that issue, the court has to address, of course, the language of the statute. We believe the court also needs to look at the statute in terms of its context, the core purpose of the statute, and the remedial public policy which is infused throughout the statute, which Lurk did not address with respect to the very important public health and safety proposal which needs to be fulfilled in the instance of this case. This is a remedial statute which is, of course, to be broadly construed to address the social harm. Now, I'd like to address very briefly Asma Masri's situation to help to put in context her experience and why she factually is an employee. She was a doctoral candidate who was assigned by the Medical College of Wisconsin, MCW, as a psychologist internship, and she was assigned to the transplant unit at Frederick Hospital. In that position, she worked 40 hours a week. She worked in the most intimate settings of the hospital, the surgical unit. She interacted daily with the hospital's patients. She interacted daily with the entire professional staff. She had full access to professional staff meetings. She had full computer access to all HIPAA-protected medical records. She was under the direct and total supervision of the psychologist who was in charge of the psychological services for the transplant. She was in a perfect position to understand the medical process and to understand when an issue of misconduct or ethical violations might arise. She was perfectly situated. She was to have been employed under a contract. The record, because there has been no discovery in this case, we don't know what documents may have been exchanged that would further establish the contract status of her employment. We do know, and it's in the record, that there had been grants specifically applied for by her supervisor, one of which had already been secured, to compensate her at $500 a month for her services. Now, I'm not going to go into all the particulars of the alleged medical misconduct, which MCW had took umbrage with in their brief, but I will say that she reported in good faith medical misconduct which she believed was subject to being reported. Now, where did she report? She asked, where do I go with this information? She was directed by MCW staff to report to the MCW officer in charge of accepting employee complaints. She was never told, oh, you are not an employee. You can call the hotline. You can call the 800 number. You can contact the Department of Safety to file a complaint. No. She was ushered into, with an appointment to the office, to the individual responsible for accepting these type of complaints. She met with the officer. The officer did not say to her, I cannot accept your complaint because you're not an employee. The officer began to accept her complaint, but cut her off in midstream as she was reporting. The officer made notes on a legal yellow pad. Because there's been no discovery, we do not have those notes. We do not know what exactly happened further to her complaints, but we do know that she was cut off, and we know that within a matter of days, her employment internship was terminated. That's unambiguous. And so she was a person who stood to be in the same position as any other professional, medical professional, to be exposed to instances of medical misconduct at any given time because she was full-time working in the inner sanctums. One of the most sacred places in a hospital is the transplant unit and the trauma and the stress of the patients. That was her job, to work with these patients. Surely none of them would have thought that she was not an employee.
Counsel, I haven't read the record here, but I've been listening to the radio and reading various articles that indicate that physicians, senior physicians who have retired, have gone back to hospitals and clinics as volunteers and work as when I say volunteers, they're not paid, but they're licensed doctors. Does the record show that there are any such physicians at the hospital now? And is it, if so, is it your position that they too, like Ms. Masri, would be covered?
Well, again, Chief Justice, we have to recall that this case was dismissed as if on a motion to dismiss. There is no evidentiary record at all. She was not given the opportunity from the beginning of the case until today to develop a factual relevant record. We would point out, and we did in our briefs, that there is a provision of Wisconsin law in Chapter 146.89, which discusses the volunteer healthcare provider program, where indeed it would be in the public interest for retired medical professionals to volunteer their services, absolutely. But yes, should their reporting, if they do return to a hospital setting and discover misconduct, would they be subject to protection if it could be of any avail to them? Yes.
Under your theory.
Under our theory, of course, one of the issues is is the person in a position to benefit from the remedies that are available? If it is a retired doctor who may not be able to be terminated, all that could happen is that the volunteer services could be terminated. But would in that event, would there be any other remedy available? Well, that would have to be dictated by the other provisions of the statute. But we would say that they would be covered because the statute states very expressly that its purpose is also to have reporting of any situation, quote, which poses a potential risk to public health or safety. Common sense would dictate that if there is one retired doctor in a hospital who is operating next to a staff doctor and the staff doctor makes a mistake, that the retired doctor who is assisting should be in a position to take immediate corrective action. That may also be ethically an obligation of the doctor to do so. In this situation, Asma Masri, as a psychologist in the transplant unit, obviously worked with other staff psychologists. So if the staff psychologist next to her observed an incident of medical malpractice, that could be reported, but Asma Masri, who's identically situated standing next to her, would not be protected from retaliation? That doesn't make any sense.
But could I ask, you use the word malpractice. Was the plaintiff in a position where she had responsibilities that might theoretically have been subject to malpractice?
Well, Justice Prosser, in the papers that were submitted initially to the Equal Rights Division, we set forth two specific incidents in her report. One of them did very specifically address a situation in which she was ordered to change a psychological report to discredit a patient who was contemplating bringing a malpractice lawsuit. That was one specific instance that she reported.
Counselor, I don't think that was the import of the question. I thought the import of the question was your client herself subject to a malpractice action for the work she was doing?
I don't believe that she was subject to a medical malpractice complaint. However, she did present with a master's degree in psychology and counseling. She was working on her doctorate. What arrangements took place between Asma Masri and MCW with respect to malpractice insurance coverage of her work or other arrangements, we do not know because there has yet been no record developed. So we don't know.
Counsel, you have spent some time going into great detail about the services and incidents of Ms. Masri's internship. And, of course, this case is very important, but I wonder if you would articulate for us the rule or the test that you would like this court to, if you were writing the opinion, what would your test be? Because, of course, there will be other interns. There will be other settings. There will be other cases in which we will need to be fair and consistent. What is the test?
Well, there are some self-limiting principles which we have set forth. Obviously, all of the parties have addressed this issue, and I could go on to give any number of examples of individuals who we believe would probably not be covered, and I'm certain that opposing counsel will be addressing this argument. But our position is that there are certain criteria that should be applied because in the statute the word employee is undefined. If we look at the context and the purpose of the statute, certain principles we think are inherent. One is that the individual must have regular workplace access to medical misconduct information. As I responded to Justice Rogensack's question earlier, we are not taking the position that any person seated here today would have a claim. We are saying that people who are in the medical field, who are actually regular workplace medical personnel and have access to information which could be reported and which would advance the public interest, that they should be protected. Secondly, the individual has to be subject to retaliatory action by the employer, by the hospital. So, for example, an intern, a vendor for Coca-Cola who comes into the cafeteria to stock the Coca-Cola machine, who might be a student at UW-Madison in business, working for a distributor, comes in, hears some information and reports. Well, that individual is not someone against whom the hospital could take immediate retaliatory action, which would frustrate the the reporting purpose.
I guess my question is a bit broader. I just read an article yesterday that the New York Times, which in an editorial not too long ago criticized the practice or was very critical of the practice of using unpaid interns. And now they have instituted an unpaid internship program. And so that just brought to my mind the wide breadth and scope of different entities, institutions, charitable, for-profit, not-for-profit, in all sorts of different fields. And if we're going to articulate the test for the next case, say intern at a newspaper, what would the test be for whether they qualify as an employee, rather than just this particular case, which I certainly understand your point, but I guess my question is, how do we apply the test, if we can at all, that would emerge from this case to a different type of internship?
I think that's a question that would concern all of us. I don't think that the broader aspects of a ruling need to be articulated to cover other situations. What we're asking the court to do is to take a look at this particular statute, which is unique, and define who is protected within the contours of the statute. And the statute's entitled Health Care Worker Protection. So what we're asking the court to do is to look within the confines of this statute and this statute only, match that with the real-world circumstances of Asma Masri's internship at MCW and hold that she was entitled to protection because of all of the circumstances of her situation, because she was a regular full-time worker in the hospital. She was subject to immediate retaliation, and indeed, immediate retaliation took place. And third, she is an intended beneficiary. She can benefit from the protections that are provided to whistleblowers. That is
Okay, I'm going to make a suggestion. Why don't you say that the test is whether or not the person is an employee, but that your test for employee does not include compensation.
That is correct.
Employee is someone who, and you can do a better job than I can, employee is someone who undertakes a task. I don't want to use employee who is employed, obviously. You know, I'm trying to avoid that circular kind of definition. Someone who is contracted with, doesn't have to be a written contract, to undertake a task under the health care, that person works subject to the supervision and control of, and now you can say, a person with a supervisory status in the facility. And fill in other blanks. I would look at the statement of agency for who is an agent or master servant, and whatever your regular definition of an employee is other than paid. Now, you're just interested in 146. Now, that definition can slop over if we have it. You know, the court has interns. We use student interns from universities who work here part-time, sometimes in the summer, full-time. Sometimes they get credit. Sometimes they don't get credit. So
they never get paid, though.
Yeah, for sure.
Not in this world. Now, I view my interns as being compensated, but not in cash, which is the way I started out. They are compensated in other ways, that's the whole reason that Ms. Masri is there, because she needs this training, and that is her compensation. that they are giving her an opportunity to get training, resume building, and she may need this training in order to get her degrees. I don't know enough about this. But it seems to me that why aren't you saying you're willing to apply all of the definitions, and I don't know what they are, of an employee, but compensation in dollars is not the definitive, dispositive issue. That's what I thought you were
writing. Well, I am saying that, and there will be analysis of tangible benefits, compensation, which is a usual way of looking at employment status in an employment statute context. So when you speak about internships in different, under different programs, and back to what Justice Gableman said, other types of professional settings have different statutes and regulatory schemes which govern the circumstances of those programs. This is a health care statute. It is not an employment statute. It's a health care statute, and it has its own unique purposes, which Asma Masri was ideally situated to advance.
Counsel, in your brief, you argue, in response to the comments of the Chief and Justice Gableman, in your brief, you argue a four-part test set forth in Siemens. Siemens is a four-part test, you say, which doesn't require compensation. I think that's what they're kind of trying to steer you to, and let me be more overt in the direction. So that is, or there are other, Fine made reference to, I think, the restatement of agency, and master servant has been used, those tests in a variety of applications by the federal courts in different administrative actions. What you referenced the Seaman test before part. So what's your test for an employee that you want to advance here? In your brief, you've advanced one. Maybe there are others.
Well, we attempted in our reply brief to succinctly lay it out again to summarize everything we've been addressing. And I think the definition in this case, again, I think if you narrow the prism, which is what we're asking the court to do, we certainly appreciate that anything the court writes is going to be seized upon by counsel on both sides in subsequent cases. But we think that there are self-limiting principles within the statute, and we have drawn by analogy from other circumstances, such as the borrowed employee test, such as the volunteer health care program, to demonstrate that in unique settings that the test needs to have some flexibility to effectuate the statutory purpose. And that is one of the major disputes between the parties here, is that she was ideally situated because of her employment context to report. She did report. She's retaliated against. Why should she be denied, under all those circumstances, the protection of the statute? She's not the Coca-Cola delivery man who might, for 10 minutes a week, come in and stock some Coca-Cola bottles, and perhaps he hears something and tries to report. It would be acceptable to us to conclude that he is not protected, because his work was not for the primary benefit of the employer. He was not ideally situated during the routines of his work to discover healthcare improprieties, and he could not be subject to immediate retaliatory action. Asma Masri's unique situation was very different. Certainly, we appreciate that there is a lot of litigation nationwide around the status of interns. And, of course, in New York, again, as Justice Gableman, who reads the New York Times, knows that there was the Fox Searchlight case not too long ago.
I didn't say I read it in the Times. I read about it.
It's been widely reported that interns are now deemed employees for purposes of the Fair Labor Standard Act. So this is a nationwide issue, and I know that earlier on in our petition to review, we had cited a book, Intern Nation, which addresses the evolving circumstances and economic realities of the 21st century. I know we made a passing comment to Downton Abbey. When we lived in a Downton Abbey era, everybody knew who lived upstairs, who lived downstairs, who the masters were, who the servants were. The 21st century workplace is a very different setting. This whole generation of students coming out into the workplace now are finding all sorts of creative ways to use their education and experience, and public policy should support them in contexts like this when there is a statute designed to protect their whistleblowing. That's what we're asking for.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Jones, representing the medical colleges.
Counselor, before you begin, if you would bend the microphone down just a little bit, it'll probably
sure.
help us hear you.
I hope you can see me and hear me. Exactly.
Yes, I can see you quite well.
Okay,
thank you.
Lower that podium if you would like.
I can lower the podium?
Yes,
I think I'm okay.
No
I'm
more?
Okay. It's as low as it goes. I'll just have to stand tall.
Okay. You're doing fine.
May it please the court, I'm Amy Schmidt-Jones, and I have the privilege of representing the Medical College of Wisconsin, Inc. in this matter. Opposing counsel has argued passionately throughout this case about who the law should protect against retaliation in the interest of patient safety. It's the medical college's position that the issue in this case is what the law is, not what it should be. The question of what the law should be is a question for the legislature. The issue presented is who is protected by the anti-retaliation provisions of the Health Care Worker Protection Act. It's the medical college's position that the LURC's interpretation of that statute is the only reasonable interpretation, and that interpretation is the term employee within the meaning of that statute, means someone who is working for an employer in exchange for compensation.
We don't see compensation in the statute.
That's correct. But the common and ordinary dictionary definition of employee contemplates someone who is working in exchange for pay, for wages. And in fact, the employment relationship is inherently one, we would submit, of economic dependency. The employer needs the employee's services in order to carry out its business, and the employee is working for the employer for it, the person's livelihood.
The argument, as it finished with your opposing counsel, focused on the New York federal case of the Labor Relations Action and defining interns as employees for NLRB purposes. I see in the appendix here Department of Educational Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, a handbook for faculty, supervisors, and students. I don't have the full one. I just have what's in the appendix. But I know in this day and age with increased use of volunteers and unpaid interns that sometimes these policies by educational institutions advise that the entity, medical college, would get a rider on the workers' compensation policy. That's part of the handbook for those using interns. Does that suggestion exist in the full document that is apparently part of the record, except just excerpted in the appendix?
Your Honor, that appendix, I believe that would have been the petitioner's appendix. But I want to make a point of clarification
a lot of
here. Ms. Masri was not a student at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Yes,
Ms. Masri was a student at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And she is the one that had possession of the full handbook that would have applied to her internship. So in speaking to the contention by opposing counsel.
Let me just.
Sure.
Maybe not. I mean, I've seen these handbooks that have gone to the institution. In other words, for instance, University of Wisconsin Oshkosh has a handbook that says to those who are using their interns, we suggest that you should consider getting a rider on your workers' compensation policy. That's given to the entities that are using the interns. And I'm just wondering
if
you have
that. Record that the medical college ever received such a communication.
Okay.
And as I said, the record, the opportunity was there for Ms. Masri to make whatever assertions she had a factual basis for. I mean, this was a motion to dismiss. So everything she put into the record was taken as true. So she had the opportunity to develop that record. I do want to address the issue
before
that's raised,
you,
however. Yes.
Before you do, you indicated that an employee is one who gets something out of the job and needs the job and gives to the employer. that their functioning is important for the employer, and that's the way you framed employer-employee.
Economic dependency, correct.
And how many of non-paid interns or volunteers does Medical College have? Is that in the record, or is it on your internet site?
Not in the record, and I would submit this particular internship is not an established internship at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
But you do have some.
They provide opportunities for experiential learning that is what's required for Ms. Masri's degree. That is correct, but it was not. It's not like Medical College has a posted position that we're looking for interns in, on the transplant unit, and that they interview applicants and they bring people in to do that work. That is not the case.
But do you have any such cases at the Medical College?
Whether there are internships of that nature that are posted, and not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Not
and
to
it's
my
not
knowledge.
In the record. Okay.
It's not in the record. I do want to address this question, though. There's been bleed over in talking about the internship cases, the Black Swan case, the Fair Labor Standards Act. I think there's an important point of clarification to be made on that issue, and it was never anything that was briefed by the complaint, by the petitioner, I would point out. If one looks at that case law, first of all, the Department of Labor's guidance in that area is limited to the for-profit private sector. So the Black Swan case came out of the for-profit private sector. If one looks at the Department of Labor's guidance and their field operations handbook, they recognize a distinction for people who are working as part of their education, for the pharmacist that needs to have on-site experience, for the radiology tech that needs to have on-site experience. And the Department of Labor has taken as an enforcement position that they do not deem that an employment relationship. Ms. Masri was here for her degree. She was not here to work for the Medical College of Wisconsin. She was not an employee. And I think it's important for the court to recognize that if they accept a broader definition of this in this context, the immediate consequence is this. Not only will Ms. Masri be deemed an employee, every medical student in the state will be deemed an employee. Every nursing student in the state will be deemed an employee, subject to the provisions of this act. So what does that mean? What is a discipline against a medical student? Is it a failing grade? Is it refusing to give a nursing student a sign-off on taking the board exam? And who's going to be investigating those complaints? The Equal Rights Division. What experience do they have in evaluating and adjudicating academic decision-making, which is an area this court, U.S. Supreme Court, courts across the country have avoided? This is an absurd reading of a statute that is framed solely in terms of employment.
Counselor, when I look at the statute, I also note that the term employee is used in many places. In order to accept opposing counsel's definition, I would have to read it differently in one paragraph than another. For example, paragraph sub 2 says, any employee of a health care provider who is aware of any information. So this is the kind of employee she wants to put herself in. But if you go to sub 1 of subparagraph 2, it says the health care facility or health care provider or any employee of that facility who has violated state law. So there they're talking about the one that's doing the violation being the employee. Well, if I accept his definition, don't I have to say then that she is an employee and then she reports on anybody that's a volunteer in the hospital, because you have to use the definition the same throughout the statute.
That's
for
correct.
The same word, right?
That's correct. That's correct. I mean, the only reasonable interpretation of the statute is giving the term employee the common, ordinary meaning, which is what the approach the court usually takes in interpreting these statutes.
So how do you deal with subsection 3 that talks about retaliation, not against an employee who reported in good faith, but any person?
Discipline, correct? It talks about discipline. And I think this is the analysis that the Court of Appeals laid out, I thought, in a very persuasive fashion. Yes, there's the word person there, which is different than employee. But when you read it in the context of the entire statute, only an employee can make a protected report. Only an employee can file a complaint with the Equal Rights Division. It talks about good faith reports. Good faith is defined solely in terms of employees. Read together, the only reasonable interpretation of that is that it means employee.
So you think the legislature goofed in that they should have put in under sub 3 any employee?
I actually don't. I don't know that it was goofing as much as inartful drafting. I think
that's a goof.
Well, this fair enough. This language, though, if you look at, and these are statutes that were cited by opposing counsel in his brief, the elder abuse statute, there are other statutes dealing with retaliation for abuses in nursing homes. And this language, you could tell, was drawn to some extent from those other statutes. But what's significant about those statutes is that in addition to providing a cause of action to an employee through the Equal Rights Division, which is exactly what this statute does, those statutes also provide a cause of action to someone who is not an employee to go to circuit court and get damages. And that's not under this statute.
Is this statute with regard to employee definition ambiguous? It doesn't define employee, and I've read it several times, and for the life of me, other than they goofed by inartfully drafting it, I don't understand why they, being the legislator, chose the language any person. In sub 3, they could have just as easily said, as they did in sub 2, any employee, as they did all over the place in 2 B, C, B, and C, any employee, in D, any employee. But when you get to 3, it says any in person. They could have continued their litany and said any employee, because that employee in good faith, and they didn't. Now, we have a canon of construction that the legislature knows what they're doing. And when they use different words, they mean different things. How do you square that canon of construction with the use of different words? I've read this several times, and it leaves me realizing they use different words. And so I get to whether or not the statute is ambiguous.
Your Honor, I don't believe the statute is ambiguous. The mere absence of a definition in the statute this Court has held does not make a term ambiguous. And if you
in and of itself. Coupled with
the person language, another canon of construction is that you look at the term in context. And when you read the entire context of the statute, in terms of who can file a complaint under the statute, who can make a protected report under the statute, to whom notice is supposed to be given of the statute, when you read all of that in context, to read that term person to mean anything other than an employee is absurd and unreasonable.
I find both the majority and the dissent relying on their common sense, and both are saying any other interpretation is absurd. Well,
I would say that the dissent at the Court of Appeals was driven by a public policy purpose as a starting point as opposed to the text of the statute. And I would point out, it's our position that denying Ms. Masri a cause of action here is not inevitably going to put patients at risk. There are many opportunities for people to report violations. And in addition, as I mentioned before, NCW allowed her in there on a gratuitous basis. It had no obligation to do it. And if you open up a front of litigation on this side with an expansive interpretation, these experiential learning opportunities may come into question and may not be provided.
Counsel,
yes.
I'd like to ask you a question, and I won't ask it again to opposing counsel, but if he chooses to address it, he can. What is our standard of review in this case? And second, can you think of any unintended consequences if we rule in favor of Ms. Masri here?
Standard of review in terms of agency deference?
Correct.
It's the medical college's position that this should be a due weight case. I do not dispute that the LURC has not interpreted specifically what the meaning of the term employee is under the statute, but by the legislature's choice to give LURC enforcement authority over this statute, and given LURC's vast experience in the context of employment relations, not giving some deference to the agency is inappropriate for that basis. And this Court has found, even with issues of first impression, that given the expertise of the agency and the legislative choice to charge the agency with administering a statute, that due weight deference can be appropriate.
Unintended.
As far as the unintended consequences, that would go to some of what I've already touched on here. These educational opportunities that are provided, you know, not exchanged for any compensation on the part of the institution, are critical to training our healthcare providers. healthcare providers are trained on the job. These opportunities, Ms. Masri needed to have it in order to get her doctoral degree. If you start expansively defining employee, it injects a tremendous amount of uncertainty into this area as to what the obligations of an institution like the medical college would be, and it can chill the opportunity. The medical college may not provide future internships. Going to the Chief Justice's question, they would have to reevaluate whether their central mission is training doctors, not providing internships for doctoral candidates at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So you would be chilling those opportunities. And as I mentioned before, you also then would bring large groups of students under the coverage of this statute, making the Equal Rights Division responsible for adjudicating academic decisions, which courts have historically said, we don't go there. We are not in a good place to assess the wisdom of academic decisions. And to me, that's truly an absurd consequence of that reading of the statute. Yes, I see my red light.
Counsel?
Yes.
What's the difference between due weight and no weight deference?
Due weight is that the court will uphold the finding of the agency absent a more reasonable interpretation. Under no weight, I mean, functionally, if the court believes that there is a more reasonable interpretation of this statute than the one espoused by the agency, the result is the same under due weight and no weight.
That's right. Court has to decide once the more reasonable or most reasonable interpretation. If it happens to be with the agency's, swell. If it's not, then the court substitutes its interpretation under either due weight or no weight. But you know what? It sounds nicer to say we're giving due weight to the agency than saying no weight.
Well, due weight is the middle deferential determination. There's great weight, due weight, and no weight, right?
And under Chapter 227, there is a recognition that the court is supposed to take into account the technical expertise of
That's
the agency.
Sure.
And here the legislature did charge this agency with administering this statute.
But functionally, they're the same. Whatever is the most reasonable.
If it is the conclusion of the court that there's a more reasonable interpretation.
Then if it's due weight or no weight, the result is the same. The agency's interpretation is not taken.
And I believe that's in the case law.
And if one of the unintended consequences is that maybe the medical college would have to get rid of its interns, so I'm assuming it would have to replace these interns with paid staff or give lesser services.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor.
So lesser services. Or she's
not there for training purposes.
Okay.
I don't think that there would be additional hiring of employees by the medical college because a person like Ms. Masri is not there learning.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So the college is giving office space. Does she have an office? Or don't we know
I
that?
Don't recall if that was a part of the record.
All right. I'll check it. Thank you.
May
That's
I?
That's all right. Just Brasser.
Mr. Albrecht was asked a question about the remedies that are available in this case, and I think he talked about vindication of the plaintiff and possible attorney fees. Do you have any comment on remedies?
I think that highlights, again, that the meaning of employee under the statute is the traditional meaning of one who works in exchange for pay, because the remedies are the Fair Employment Act remedies. The main remedy under the Fair Employment Act is back pay and reinstatement into a job. I mean, what exactly is going to make her whole under the statute? Getting her attorney paid? Having there is not a make-whole remedy for Ms. Masri under the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act.
What about reinstatement?
Then that would be the court telling an academic institution that you need to accept this student into your program, which what I would suggest has First Amendment implications and academic freedom implications.
Mm-hmm. Is the medical college part of the state, so this is state action?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's a private institution.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney Stephen C. Kilpatrick, Assistant Attorney General.
May it please the Court. Thank you. My name is Stephen Kilpatrick, and I represent the Labor and Industry Review Commission. I'd like to take some time to talk about the standard of review in this case. The commission does ask for due weight deference in this situation. And the reasons are as follows. The commission has already interpreted the Health Care Worker Protection Act on one occasion and determined that only employees are protected by this statute. Only employees are entitled to file complaints, not all persons. Two, it has extensive experience in determining who is or isn't an employee under similar statutes. The commission obviously interprets Fair Employment Act statutes, Workers' Compensation Act statutes, and it uses...
Do you have different definitions for employee under these various statutes?
Well, under Fair Employment Act statute that I know of, it's one of those circular employee definitions.
No, but workers' comp, unemployment comp, every time I look at them, they are different definitions for who's an employee. For example, let's see, what was it?
How about a contractor under in workers' comp?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
A contractor under in workers' comp?
I'm not aware of that.
How about a borrowed employee?
Well, a borrowed employee, that test was brought up by opposing counsel, and it's the commission's position that that is simply an inapplicable argument to be made at this point in litigation, but also because the borrowed employee test presumes that there are wages paid. There are wages paid by the first employer, and the issue is whether the next borrowing employer is the employer. So wages are presumed in that test, and I don't think the borrowed employee test is applicable here.
The different statutes have different definitions of what's an employee. So it could be an employee for federal income tax purposes. It could be an employee for Social Security purposes. And it's not an employee for workers' comp. Right?
Right. But here, sorry.
Different statutes use different definitions of employee, whether precisely so defined or through administrative regulation or through practice. So there is no one definition that I have found that covers every single statute that uses the word employee. Do you agree with that?
I agree.
Okay. My second thing is, do you agree with Ms. Jones that due weight deference and no deference winds up the same in the sense that the court has to look for what are reasonable interpretations and select the most reasonable one?
Yes.
Either way,
yes.
It doesn't matter.
But
it really is nicer to say that you give deference due weight, isn't it?
It is, and that's why we would like that. But
that's right. But the result is the same.
But the result is the same. But in this sense, I do want to address one argument that I do not find persuasive, the commission doesn't find persuasive from the other side, is that no deference should be given because of the case of first impression argument. I've addressed that before, previously. But the other argument is that the commission's interpretation is unreasonable. And I believe that that argument is unreasonable.
It doesn't have to be unreasonable. You just have to have something that's more reasonable. You can have two or more reasonable interpretations. The court has to determine which one it thinks is more reasonable. And I think your briefs were very careful about that most of the time, that saying, hey, what's the more reasonable one? And every once in a while it would slip into, this is a reasonable interpretation. And of course, that's not the standard.
Right.
Counsel, at the risk of not later going back into conference and having some of my colleagues say to me, you know, everyone agreed there's only two standards here, great weight and no weight. Are you sure that what you're saying here is due weight and no weight are the same thing? Because our case law has had three levels of deferential review. I didn't understand you to be saying that, but I've experienced this many times now where someone gets a concession and then they say, see, counsel even agreed it's the same. I don't want to risk changing years and years of precedent with something you just said. So
right.
Could you clarify that for me?
Yes, of course. My answer was effectively due weight and de novo review are result result the same. But there are three levels of deference: great weight, due weight, and de novo review. And de novo review is employed if there is a case of first impression or if there is an unreasonable interpretation here. And that doesn't apply here. As I explained before, the commission has extensive experience in dealing with who is or isn't an employee, and it has already addressed this Health Care Worker Protection Act. So therefore, due weight deference is the proper weight to be given in this case. The other side argues that it is unreasonable, the commission's interpretation is unreasonable, and therefore de novo review is proper. And I completely disagree with that. In this case, the commission saw a statute, uses the word employee.
Used
the common ordinary definition of the word of an employee is someone who usually obtains wages or salary in exchange for services. Same goes with the definition of employee. Wages or salary are presumed. The commission interpreted that statute to include those only who receive wages. It even said in its decision, even if that's not the case, even if wages, financial compensation of some sort, isn't the key, then let's look at the possibility of the receipt of tangible benefits. In this case, Ms. Masri didn't even receive tangible benefits. So there is no reason for the commission not to presume that its interpretation applied to Ms. Masri was unreasonable. It was reasonable. The legislature has not defined the term, but the courts can look to the ordinary and common definition of employee, and that generally has wages.
Counsel, please go.
Is there any suggestion that Ms. Masri was not acting in good faith?
No, I don't believe that was considered by the DWD, the Equal Rights Division investigator, or the ALJ of the DWD or the commission. I believe that the commission looked at what she was receiving. What she was receiving was not compensation, was...
But you're not suggesting that she was not acting in good faith. So then what would you say is the remedy for all that she experienced if we were to say she's not an employee?
What she could seek, other avenues that she could seek as a remedy? Is that your question?
Yeah. I mean, she basically was sacked, disrupted her educational career, stigmatized. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's the remedy?
Well, I think at that point you get out of the purview and jurisdiction of the Labor and Industry Review Commission. The commission is there to accept, or the DWD is there to accept complaints of employees, just as it does under the Fair Employment Act, workers' compensation. It's the Department of Workforce Development. It looks at workers who receive wages. And therefore, if there is no possibility that Ms. Masri or anyone else who doesn't receive wages can file a complaint under the statute, then it is out of the jurisdiction of the commission. And I would defer to Ms. Jones's.
So I assume you work for the Wisconsin Department of Justice.
Yes.
You're interested in justice.
Yes.
You're a philosopher. What's the remedy for this young woman?
Well, I believe that the remedies were pointed out in the brief of the medical college, that there were other avenues of reporting that Ms. Masri could have taken. So there could have been anonymous reports. There could have been several reports to various government agencies. There was no need for her to report, to file a report with the employer. Actually, not even an employer at this point. The medical college, so excuse me.
I understood your position in your brief, counsel, to be that compensation is not necessary to be an employee,
if there is another tangible benefit. Do I understand your position correctly?
Well, the position of the commission, and hopefully it was a position in the brief, is that financial compensation is the key, wages or salary. That is the key to the employee-employer relationship. However, the commission rejected the argument that that was not a requirement. But then it went on and said, even if wages and salary don't need to be present to determine such a relationship, and only tangible benefits need be received by the person to be considered an employee. Even in this case, Ms. Masri didn't meet that threshold. She didn't receive any tangible benefits in exchange for her services.
So what is the position, what is your position here today, just for clarification? For instance, if she received some benefits but no salary or wages, would you be saying that she is not an employee?
Well, I must take the position of the commission in its decision where it said that compensation is the key. Financial compensation is the key, salary or wages. And then if we turn to tangible benefits, even if that's possible, the federal courts have shown they have analyzed cases in which wages and salary may not be present, but they considered vacation, sick pay, health insurance, those types
sure.
of things.
But you're not you're nuancing it, and I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to make sure I understand the nuance.
Right. Yes.
And that is your position here today on behalf of your client is it has to be salary or wages. There has to be a salary or a wage, or there cannot be an employee. That's your position today.
Yeah, that is the position that the commission has taken, that the commission has historically taken in analyzing similar statutes.
Do you think that's right when you take a look at some federal legislation that would include the or tangible benefit? I mean, I thought that's really where you were. I guess I didn't quite get the nuance of the argument. I thought your argument was or other tangible benefit. So,
well,
what about all those cases that deal with or other tangible benefit? That's not something we want here in Wisconsin.
Well, the federal courts, which the commission looked to and cited in its decision, have used this threshold remuneration test regarding financial compensation of some sort. So there need not be wages or salary. There may be some certain type of benefits that have some monetary value, and that may be considered financial compensation. But historically, the commission has looked to wages or salary in determining whether one is an employee or not. And in this case, the volunteer versus employee analysis, I believe, should focus on wages or salary simply because, in this case, the legislature has not chosen to define employee. The common ordinary term includes wages or salary. It has created a process by which employees file complaints with the Department of Workforce Development, which considers employment-related matters, and then on appeal goes to the Labor and Industry Review Commission, which deals with employment matters. Neither the commission nor the DWD, to my knowledge, has any involvement in volunteer matters. Everything is in regard to employment matters.
Judge Fine says that your interpretation, and not meaning you personally, counsel, defeats the legislative purpose, that it frustrates what the legislature wanted to accomplish. And besides some other legislative discussion, in particular, he points to the statute that we are focusing on, 146.997, sub 2.2, and the purpose is the potential risk to public health or safety. So he says it isn't just about the individual involved. that legislatively there is a public interest, and your interpretation defeats and frustrates that public interest. Ergo, an interpretation, you know, can't defeat it and be reasonable. Can you respond to that?
Sure. Thank you. Yes. The response would be that yes, the Health Care Worker Protection Act, one of its purposes may be the protection of patients, the health care of patients. However, it's not the primary purpose. The primary purpose of this statute from the text needs to be the protection of employees in healthcare facilities and for healthcare providers. Now, the Healthcare Worker Protection Act may be a way to protect patients, but it's not the only way. And this court need not give employee in this statute an uncommon meaning when we believe that it was the legislature's intent, the meaning of employee is its common and ordinary meaning. So, yes, the Act may have a secondary purpose of protecting patients, but its primary purpose is protecting healthcare workers. I notice my time is up. Thank you.
I have a question. I become intrigued with the concept of academic freedom and that. So suppose we're at the University of Wisconsin Hospital, and we have employee doctors who are faculty members working at the hospital, and they get paid by the hospital. So you have an assistant professor paid at the hospital and in a clinical department, and he or she is a whistleblower under 146.997 and whistleblows against a full professor who's not happy. And then there's some disciplinary action. The assistant professor contract isn't renewed or fired for one reason or other, but of course not because he reported the full professor. That would be covered here, would it not?
If the university of the hospital would be considered a healthcare facility or a healthcare provider.
I hope it is.
Assuming it is.
I go there.
Under the statute.
Okay. All right. But, so let's see what it says about healthcare facility. It's a hospital. Well, we're okay.
Okay.
I assume it's licensed.
Yes. Go ahead. So if that reporting doctor was being paid.
Absolutely. And well paid.
And if payment is in the form of wages or salary and other types of
absolutely
tangible benefits.
So you're into the academic. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel?
I'd like to address 2 points raised in each of the respective arguments. First, following up with some additional comment with respect to Justice Ziegler's question on the standard of review. Specifically, if when you analyze this case, if you go to our briefs, our main briefs, we addressed at page 11 certain of the cases. Admittedly, there are a thicket of cases addressing standard of review. But the one point I want to make is that this Court has declared more than once, and I will now quote from the Mercy Care case cited, which references this principle that due weight deference will, quote, in most situations, lead to the same result as would applying no deference at all. That is how this Court looks at the distinctions between the two deferences, because this Court must adopt, and this is now a quote from the recent Jamerson case, must adopt without regard for the agency's interpretation what the Court views as the most reasonable interpretation of the statute. That's from Jamerson. Now, with respect to MCW's argument, which we characterize not to be banal, but a slippery slope argument, I must ask the question, why would MCW have fear of people reporting alleged medical misconduct? What does that say? The literature that is developing around whistleblowing indicates that that whistleblowing presents an opportunity for the institution to re-examine its own internal policies and procedures, its training of staff, its risk management policies, and the oversight.
Is that really the question? I mean, your public policy arguments are very well made, but I have to interpret the statute to decide what results should come in this case. And when I interpret a statute, the public policy is established by the legislature. That's who put the statute together. So for me, though I think you do a good job of setting out strong public policy arguments, we can't change what the legislature did based on public policy arguments because the statute evidences the public policy chosen by the legislature. So I keep coming back to interpretation of employee under the statute because my first question to you was, if she's not an employee, do you lose? And you said yes. And that's what I think we need to focus
yes.
on.
Yes. And because employee is not defined, and we have from all of the colloquies presented this morning, it seems that we are in agreement, or at least I would propose, that the word is ambiguous in the context of this statute. The interpretive principles this court applies then goes to the context of the statute infused with the public policy. Now, one other comment, Justice Rogensack, is that keep in mind that this statute came out of a line of cases, including most directly the Houseman case and its predecessors, in which this court overturned, to an extent, common law accepted at-will employment situations to adopt and impose public policy as a restraint on the activities of employers to terminate employment because of the paramount of public policy. Now, I would suggest that these can be harmonized, that there can be a symbiotic relationship. The court has spoken, the legislature reacts, the court speaks again. This isn't a isolated situation. This court has in the past now, in a clear line of cases going back 25 years, utilized public policy in its decision making. And what we're suggesting today to the court is that the case is not defined solely by the public policy, but by, of course, interpretation of the statute with respect to which public policy is one component.
I'm surprised you didn't cite some of the cases that say you look at the spirit of the statute.
Yes, we have cited that. It's the spirit of the statute, the remedial purpose of the statute. It is, quite frankly, somewhat surprising to me to continue to read language in which this court has said that this court must deal with the harm that the legislature has chosen to address and give expression to that judicially. And in this case, it cannot be disputed. The public policy is not something that's external. It is infused in the statute, in the language of the statute.
Well, the answer on the Attorney General's office, which is has persuasive value, is that this is not designed to protect public health. And the client here, the patient, but is designed to protect the whistleblower. And that you're trying to turn this on its head to say this is a public health statute when it's really an employee protection statute. What's your response to that?
Well, Lurk's analysis is truncated. Because whistleblowing, yes, that is the purpose of the statute. But what counsel omitted is whistleblowing with respect to what? With respect to incidents that occur in the medical setting which could impact the health and safety of patients and the public. Not whistleblowing because someone didn't pay for their Coca-Cola in the vending machine. whistleblowing with regard to medical serious issues of misconduct and ethical violations. So you have to join together those public purposes and link the two expressed purposes in the statute.
So you think this statute has at least two purposes?
Well, I think that they're intertwined. They're both expressed in the language of the statute. And Lurk's analysis and opinion totally ignores the second public purpose, as Judge Fine found. Now, one other comment I'd like to briefly make with respect to...
Your red light is on, so wind it up, please.
Okay. With respect to definition of employee, it is a misstatement, I believe, to say that there must be wages. We've had dueling dictionaries. The word usually for wages appears in the dictionary, which means that the context of the employment situation controls the definition. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank all counsel, you, Mr. Albrecht and Ms. Jones and Mr. Kilpatrick, for their briefs and arguments today in a statute that I don't think has been before us before, raising statutory interpretation and public policy issues, and a matter of interest to the court, and I'm assuming the students here on with regard to internships. So that concludes our hearing in 12 AP 1047, Asma Masri versus Lurk. The court will take a few minutes recess so the students who are here may leave and additional students may enter the hearing room.